Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. New SkinGuard Sensitive Razor. The first razor of its kind designed to stop irritation on sensitive skin. Gillette, the best a man can get.
It's Thursday, the 2nd of January, and only 357 sleeps until Christmas. Time to get your game on.
So just how does Klopp approach holiday team selection?
It's not the biggest number, so we have to... Yeah, it's not always easy to make the right decisions.
Jose Mourinho makes even more friends in Southampton.
I think the yellow card is fair because I was rude, but I was rude to an idiot.
And it's snake bites all round as Scotsman Peter Wright wins his first world title at the Ali Pally.
I couldn't believe the first one didn't go in or the second one. And I thought, oh, don't do it again because Michael's quite easy to come back with $9. But, you know, I've done it.
All that and a lot more between now and 8 o'clock on Game On. Text us on 51552.
Game On 2FM.
Marie, we're back up and going. Looking forward to the new year?
Yeah, I think so.
Any resolutions? Is that what they're called?
Yeah, try and do more steps. I ended up only doing 91 steps yesterday because I sat on the couch and watched the football and the darts. So wow. I managed to keep it under 100 for the whole day, which is pretty impressive.
Well, at least you were working doing that. I watched Back to the Future and The Sound of Music. There was a complete difference.
There was, yeah. How did you end up having to watch them and not the football and the darts?
Oh, they're two big ones now with our kids. Well, I'll be honest with you, Back to the Future is a classic. I was always going to push for it.
You need to get a second TV.
You must have loved it, though. It was a brilliant Christmas. Did you have a good one?
I had a great one, yeah. I was down at home in Clare and I was in Kerry and I went to see my first Gaelic football match of the season. Cork and Kerry.
You sent me a WhatsApp about it.
I did. You weren't one bit impressed.
How many people were at it?
1,548.
Wow.
Yeah. I think there was 3,000 people at the Waterford Cork hurling match. So there's a huge appetite for these pre-season games because people haven't had GAA for so long that when it comes back and it's, you know, competitive enough that they want to go out and see who the new players are and what's happening and what they've missed. And I was one of them.
Can I ask, how did that Cork-Kerry game go?
Cork won. Very well, very convincingly, but Kerry had like a third string team out. It was under 20. They were all away on holiday, so there wasn't too many big names playing. And Cork had a pretty strong team out. They were very impressive. They were motoring well for December.
Okay, well, does anyone care
how
you
go? Loads to look forward to.
Yeah, true. Well, to be fair, January, you know, we leave you get excited about it. You deserve to. Do you know what the highlight for me of the kind of sporting was? Kind of sport over the Christmas? The horse racing.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe it's hanging around with Ruby, but I actually feel now, you know, the way we're chatting about all these horses like Sam Crowe, Notepad, Ken Boy, and then you see them in the races, you're like, oh my God, that's the one Ruby was on about.
It's kind of hard not to get excited about it when he talks about it so much, to be honest.
But the thing is, I think everyone listening is in with a great opportunity for, you know, those kind of water cooler moments, or just when you want to seem cool around your friends, when you can drop a brilliant line about horse racing. So that's what we should look for every time out of Ruby, you know, that we're able to kind of go, you know, next time someone's chatting about horse racing, that you can kind of go, Faheen is looking good on the soft ground.
Or people keep asking me, does Ruby give us tips because we're on the show with him? And
explain what happened.
I did. I told him that one time he texted us a 25-1 winner and neither of us could make sense of it and just didn't even back it, so...
Do you know what I love about it as well, though? Ruby's so anti kind of putting a few quid on something.
Yeah, he's just not into it. Yeah. Or else he just doesn't tell us, one or the other.
Well, he said it to me. Like, I was there, Jeannie, that's a great tip. And he was there, just enjoy the racing. Don't bother with the... Not great for his...
Yeah, true, yeah. Well, he just, like, for him, it's a way of life. He loves every single bit of it, so...
He loves it,
doesn't he? We had to get on board
he?
With him over the Christmas.
Yeah. You'd miss him, wouldn't you?
No.
The angry little
yes.
elf. Yeah, it was a competitive time around my house as well. I beat all my four kids in Connect Four and Jenga.
And I haven't mentioned the Celebrity Fitness Family yet.
Yeah, move on. It didn't go as
when
well.
When you said a competitive time for you, I thought you were going to mention the Fitness Family, which I really enjoyed.
Did you?
Yeah, seeing Jackie giving it loads.
Jackie did, to be fair to her, and the O'Sullivans gave it loads. But I'll be honest, as soon as everyone saw the Heffernans in the car park, it was like... Okay, whoever gets them now wins.
Well, I mean, two Olympians, two international soccer players, you don't really stand a chance when you're up against competition like that. So it made Jackie's achievement even more impressive to be second.
Look at you shouting out for your mates. Do you know what? The weakest link on that Heffernan team were the parents. Like, they've had their run. It's like their kids are phenomenal.
They were so impressive. And I think it was one stage Rob mentioned it, that they were just so calm. Like, the way they were going through that swamp, wading through it, the daughter tiny and the water coming up nearly to her chin and not a bother on her. She just kept going.
Do you know
Look
what
at
I
me
love?
Talking about fittest family. What is this?
Just give me this one. Rob Heffernan just shows that you can never lose that competitive spirit. They were so far ahead of one of the families in it that they couldn't get a camera on both of them. So they were losing the kind of shot. And Marion, his wife, said, "Rob, slow down, we've won." And he was there, "Keep it down, will you?"
Oh, God, I can imagine him.
He just couldn't handle it.
He wouldn't give an inch. I'd say he just wouldn't give an inch in a competition, in a race, anything like that.
But isn't that brilliant that he's involved so in a coaching role, you know, with Brendan Boyce, that we know kind of going into Tokyo, these are the type of people that are mentoring. We better give Derv a mention, Derv O'Rourke, the winning coach, trying to get them in line.
Look at you, giving credit to another coach.
To be fair to her, she deserves it. She's actually, if I had to have a coach on it, I'd want Derv, because she gives you really good technical points. All the rest of us shouting are all rubbish.
She's determined, you can see it in her.
I love chatting for the family. Can we just chat about for the family for the rest of it? What about Donica's too talented, no?
I didn't see that, but the amount of people that came up to me over the Christmas and said, "I saw Donica on the kids show, he's brilliant."
Stop, my head. I won't be able to get out of the room.
I said, "Joe, you should just stick to the kids' TV." Leave him there.
My teammates do slag, though, that I get on well with kids because we're on the same level.
I'm not sure what to say to that.
We get on.
Oh, no. Right, moving on to the sport, because mm-hmm. Fittest Family is not sport.
Yeah.
Liverpool are playing tonight against Sheffield United in Anfield. A huge match for Liverpool, in my opinion. But the story that was coming out of Liverpool today was Sheffield United were taking a bit of a training session, a bit of a run around Stanley Park, which is right beside Anfield. So anyone who was out walking their dog today were in for a treat to see the Sheffield United team putting on some bibs, doing a bit of hard work, doing some drills. And it got me thinking, you as a former professional athlete, have you ever trained anywhere a bit random?
Yeah, we have. When we used to do a walkthrough with Munster, we used to stay in the Clayton Hotel in Limerick, and there's this kind of scrapyard to the left of it. And we used to do our line-out walkthrough and backs plays there before the game. And you'd see people randomly kind of walking by, kind of going, "Is that John Hayes in the scrapyard?" And as well, when we were lucky enough to be in the Irish camp, we'd stay in the Shelburne, and you'd cross the road into Stephen's Green, and you'd go through your plays there the morning of a match. Would be priceless, though. Like, to be some old fella walking his dog in the middle of a line-out through someone like, you know, Rory Best and Paul O'Connell just barging him out of the way to continue with his walk. But people tended to kind of leave you alone. But I think it's actually good for players as well that you don't feel so isolated and out of it. Of course, you hear horror stories about some teams training in car parks and different things like that. What about you? Have you ever trained in a dodgy surrounding?
Well, we've, as a female former sports person, we've definitely had to train and play in a lot of places where there was no bathrooms, and have knocked on many a door of houses next to pitches. And
no way.
Yeah, people are generally pretty sound.
Yeah, of course they're sound, but that is shocking that there isn't those facilities.
Yeah,
it?
Well, like, that's the way it is for a lot of female sports teams, that they have the worst pitches because they don't own any of them and they just have to take what they get, and a lot of them just don't even have bathrooms. So
it's not all well. That is so sad, isn't it? Like, yeah. Honestly, like,
it's getting better, but I mean, still we'd find that there could be Gaelic football or camogie fixtures and they won't know where they're playing until a few days beforehand because there's no availability of pitches. And when weather is bad, like the time of the snow particularly, it was so hard for teams to get pitches, and you just nearly have to take what you get. So I would imagine or hope that in the future, that if the GAA does become go under one umbrella and you've got camogie and ladies football all part of one organisation, that things might get a little bit better. But as it stands now, it's difficult for anyone involved in female GAA and female sports to get access to facilities. That's, I know, starting 2020 off on a lovely note.
Oh, there you go. And dead right. Like, we go bang on so much about the fixtures, but that seems a bigger problem than anything, isn't it? Just basic facilities, because they're there. Why don't we use them for all. Seems mad. But
we'll get Ruby on the case. He's going to fix the fixtures and he can fix the facilities
no,
as well.
Don't draw him. He'll distract everyone from getting it done. But we'd love to hear from you at home or if you're in the car. 51552, where's the oddest place that you've trained or had to prepare for one of your games? Sheffield United getting prepared to play against Liverpool tonight in Stanley Park. We'd love to hear where you've had some of your training sessions. All right, time for a quick break. 2FM.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette Skin Guard Sensitive, the first razor of its kind designed to stop irritation on sensitive skin. So say bye-bye to shave irritation and razor bumps. Gillette, the best a man can get.
So, Donica, it was a very exciting sports year and a very exciting Christmas. And our lovely producer, Andrew, has spent a very long time putting together this brilliant montage of the highlights.
I'm glad he did something.
I was really pleased with the team performance. The players were magnificent from the start. They really bought into the idea that, you know, they need to give the supporters back something, and I thought today they did.
Today was perfect. New year, new opportunity against a big club behind our fans. We are delighted to get a win.
I want to try my best to help the team to be better and to help the club to be competitive. There's a lot of time that this club didn't win.
And it's Charger on the near side of Penny Mouchoir as they come to the final flight. They land together. Charger on the near side and Patrick Mullins are gaining the upper hand at the Madison Hurdle. Running to the finish, Charger and Patrick Mullins have done it again. Penny Mouchoir second.
Yeah, he was good. Classical Dream and Penny Mouchoir went at it. I think Classical Dream probably just couldn't go the pace.
Running up towards the finish in the Frank Ward Memorial Hurdle. What is it about Apples Jade and Leopardstown is getting a great reception from the crowd?
Unbelievable, this is great. We knew we'd come on from the run, but great for Jack. Listen, Jack's been plagued with injuries lately, and come back and have a double great one like this. It's unbelievable, very special.
Inside the final 200 yards, it's Notebook from Bekir Nudiri. But Notebook will progress to the next level over fences. This day belongs to Rachel Blackmore and Henry de Robin.
You should never give up. It doesn't matter how many times you get beaten. You know, I used to go and meet Michael Taylor, Gary Hamilton all the time, and then Getty Price. All these good players keep coming through. I'm thinking, all these players keep getting in my way. And it's like, I've done it.
They definitely took their chances. I thought 14-3 at half time. If we could have breached their line there, might have been different, but mate, we didn't. We had a lot of opportunities too, and credit to their defence. They held out, then they come out after the second half and put two quick scores on us, and the game's dead. So, well, when you dominate the Quizzes the way they did, you probably deserve a scoreline like that.
Yeah, it was awesome. The boys working really hard around the corner there. The back stepped up as well, took a few good carries, so it was good to get the reward for a lot of time spent in the 22, yeah.
But we didn't start the game well enough. But we conceded a few penalties and they kicked us into the corner, and you know that try was the ultimate difference. I thought we had some good reaction in the second half. I thought we played with the wind pretty well, kept them in their corners. Unfortunately, just weren't accurate enough to finish it there at the end to get at least a draw.
Tough game. It probably lacked a bit of accuracy from both teams, I think would be fair to say. You know, lots of endeavour, I think, out there, and you know, gets both sets of players, you know, digging in defensively in particular. Probably lacked a little bit of cutting edge quality in attack from both teams. But yeah, like, we're pleased to come away and get a win.
Now, that was a montage of all the sporting highlights over the last few days. Now, it has been a very busy Christmas and New Year period in the Premier League. Stephen Kelly, former Republic of Ireland and Spurs footballer, joins us in studio. Stephen, I was looking at the table today and we look at the top foot. Liverpool are sitting up there, 55 points. Then you've Leicester in second on 45, Man City on 44. And then you look down, you've got Chelsea, Man United and Spurs all kind of vying for that fourth spot. Are the top three done and dusted?
Yeah, you would think so. I can't see, well, Liverpool are running away with it. You can't see them being caught at all by anybody. And then it's between City and Leicester for second. And I think City will come up trumps in the end just because of the quality they have. But you just find Leicester are going to be, unless they have some catastrophic events between now and the end of the season, dropping that many points is, doesn't seem feasible for them, and the teams below just keep winning and losing back-to-back games. They don't seem to be putting a run together enough. Arsenal now seem like maybe they could be on a turn after a good win, but even them, you're not too sure, and it's going to depend on how well these teams strengthen in the January window. That's going to be imperative to how well they kick on for the rest of the season.
Is it still exciting considering that the top three pretty much are done and dusted?
I think what makes it more exciting is the fact that if Liverpool win, it's the first time. That's what makes it exciting for everybody, because they haven't done it before, and if they're going to win it in the fashion that they have done to this point so emphatically, it's going to be exceptional. So it's amazing to see if they continue on in the vein, the form that they have been to finish it so high, and the fact that City were so good last season, to knock them off their perch like they have done so far, has just been exceptional. So it still makes it very interesting. And then that fight for fourth place, it's almost going to be more interesting to see who misses out, like what huge club is not going to be in the Champions League next year.
Stephen, it's really interesting though with Liverpool. Have they been, I know everyone's been saying, oh, they've had an awful lot of games, but have they been lucky with that as well? Like tonight, no, they know exactly what they need going out every time.
Yeah, it's, I think as well, having a lot of games and having a team that performing well, you just roll into the next game almost like you're robotic in a sense. You just continue on winning, and when you're winning games back to back, you go into every game not feeling aches or pains or injuries or knocks, because you're on a high. So for them, I'm sure the manager wants to have it spread out a bit more, because he doesn't want that many games in the legs in such a short space of time. But when you go away and you win the World Cup in club sense, to come back then and go throughout the Christmas period unbeaten as well, they've just been phenomenal.
What does he do tonight then? I know we don't have the team news. Is it a case where he just plays his best team because it's a Premier League game, and then maybe rest for Everton, and then you've got Spurs coming up as well?
I honestly think you feel he's going to play his best team, but then you look at what he did against Everton. With him, he brought in Origi, he brought in Shaqiri, he brought Lallana, and those players came in and really did well for him. So I think this season, more so than most for Klopp, he's been able to change his team, and the players that have been on the periphery have really stood up to the task and have come in and performed really well. So for me, I think he might change it slightly. But he's going to be very wary of Sheffield United, because they're a team that are on the up, and you can't take them for granted. They're a good side. They play a very different style of football to everybody else, and you got to feel that they're a team that can nick a win against you. So I'm sure he's going to be wary of them.
Will we see Minamino tonight?
I know. I'd like to see him. I'm actually looking forward to seeing him in the Premier League and see how he copes. But,
and where he plays.
Yeah, where he plays. But technical-wise, he's a very technically gifted player. So, you know, hopefully he fits in and slots into the form. But, you know, Klopp, he's the type of manager that he likes to get his players up to speed before he plays them. So hopefully that's going to be the case with him.
Stephen, just on that, you've been a player and have to welcome guys into the dressing room. It seems like Liverpool just went a brilliant way about going about it. I know an awful lot of it leaked out onto social media, but you felt like he joined a massive family, didn't you?
Yeah, I think that's what Klopp is. He's kind of created this atmosphere around the place that everybody's in it for each other, and they're coming in and they're one spirit and there's one team, and the unity involved in the club at the moment seems really special. So, you know, coming into that environment is only going to progress him as a player and make him feel welcome, which is great. As a new signing, you want to be welcomed in and feel like you're wanted, and you know they've made that evident, which is great.
It's the hugs, Donica.
It's the hugs.
It's the hugs.
But Stephen, it's some bit of business by him though in terms of signings. That is a really shrewd one.
Yeah, very shrewd one. And I think he's been exceptional in the signings he's made. You know, everybody questioned what it was, Van Dijk and Alisson, they were the two that, you know, when they came in, how were they going to change the team, and that was the positions they were screaming out for. Van Dijk now seems like a bargain at 75 million. Like, what would you pay for him now?
Everybody would take him for
you'd pay double
especially
that for
when you look at Harry Maguire.
Oh, you'd absolutely you'd pay double for him. And to think that not only is he classed as the best defender, he's classed as the best, one of the best players in the world now. Not just that, like, he was pushing Ronaldo and Messi for the Ballon d'Or. That's unbelievable. Like, the last one to win it was Cannavaro, who, you know, is a god in Italy.
And now they're like 4 clean sheets as well.
Yeah,
so.
4, exactly. And we were all talking about at the start of the season, they were winning games, but they were conceding goals. But I have to admit, I think Gomez is an absolute fantastic footballer. And him playing against Van Dijk, with Van Dijk, is just a combination that I feel is going to be brilliant. And when he gets more mature and grows into it, I think he's going to be exceptional for them once he stays fit.
Stephen, do you put that all down to Klopp, or is the recruiting system there different? Is there academy? What are Liverpool doing right that they haven't done over the last 20 odd years?
I think it's a bit of both. I've actually had an argument about this before with someone about they said that the recruitment hasn't changed in Liverpool compared to when Rodgers was there. So the argument was whether Rodgers would have had the same players to get to the same level. And that's all well and good, but a club can attract a player, but a manager attracts a player too. So Klopp being at the club is a massive pull for them. So to have him there, players will want to work with him, like Guardiola, like Mourinho. People will want to play for these managers because they want to learn from them. They want to feel like they can improve under them. And he's a massive part of who they can attract. And Liverpool are a huge club, but he's added to that by his presence and his name as a manager.
But so often we talk about playmakers and strikers and goal scorers as being the marquee signings, but he's kind of changed a little bit when you look at Van Dijk, and then you look at Alisson, and then you see other clubs around as well putting huge emphasis on their defenders because of what he's achieved with his.
Well, absolutely. You can't go and win the league unless you've got decent defenders to some extent. You can always have great attacking players, but unless you can keep the ball in your net, you're not going to win games. Man U have always done it really well. Up until the last few years, they've always had, like, when you look at Vidic, Ferdinand, people like that, they were the centre rock of their team, and then they built teams around them, and then their attacking players can go and do what they want to do. Liverpool have done it. Arsenal are screaming out for a couple of centre backs. I know he scored yesterday, which is important, but, you know, they need some solid players. Tottenham are screaming out for a couple of defenders to come in and tighten things up, and you feel that that's what's going to happen. You know, Koulibaly, he's the one that's probably on everyone's radar, and he's going to cost a lot of money, but you kind of feel like he's the next big signing as a defender that's probably going to come to the Premier League.
The transfer window is going to be interesting for a huge amount of clubs. So Arsenal yesterday, they got that win. You could see from watching the reaction to the from the crowd, like every tackle, every press, every block got a massive reaction from the fans. They really gave a good performance, didn't they, Stephen?
Yeah, they did. They played very well. They were on top for most of the game. They had a couple of really good chances, and they looked like a much better side. The shape built them. But Ozil, again, it's so hard because he is such a talent. Like, you can't.
What is wrong with him, though? Why can't he do it all the time?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. It's flawed genius, isn't it? These players that you just
so
want to shake them, don't you? And just say, listen, if you can perform at that level, we'll win most games because he's so good. And when he came into the Premier League first, he got rewarded with that contract because he was the top assists. He was the top player in creating goals. He's so influential.
He regained possession yesterday 10 times more than any other player.
Yeah, he's an exceptional talent. And, you know, whatever's gone wrong for him to dip, if you can get him back on side, they have a great opportunity. So, and I've seen people talk about it. You either go and say, right, I'm going to build a team around you to go and play and win games, or else you get rid of him. It's one or the other almost. But if you get him on side, you've got talent that you can't buy because he's so good.
Yeah, and Stephen, obviously a new manager coming in there. He's doing more than steadying the ship. Is he, like, can they push on now?
Yeah, the win yesterday was huge for them. And you feel him coming in, and the boost you get from a new manager straight away as a club, it's always instantaneous. Usually it's instantaneous. A new manager comes in and people are fighting for positions. They want to prove them. They want to be in his side. They want to be his team. So everybody gets a lift. And there's usually the team kicks on. It's whether or not the longevity can kick in, whether he has enough about him. Like, he's very inexperienced. But if he's a quarter of what Guardiola is as a manager, and based that around the fact he did a lot of his training under him, learned a lot from him, then he could come on to be a fantastic manager. And, you know, he's a young one and they're taking a risk, but it's good to see Arsenal doing that and taking someone in that's not proven.
There was a lot of comparisons made between him and Guardiola yesterday, just the style of play, that 5-second law that we all know Guardiola likes his teams to play with, just chasing the ball all the time. Did you see it?
Yeah, I saw it. And you can see, like, that high energy and being animated on the touchline. And when you see Guardiola, he kicks every ball, and he's possessed on the sideline. He's telling them where to go. Every movement he's dictating. And, you know, it must be exhausting for a manager's sideline. It's like he plays the game, but
so emotional.
Yeah, so emotional. And Arteta, you know, I'm not sure he's as emotionally as attached as he is, but he will dictate everything. I'm sure he'd go through everything, like, with a fine tooth comb. And, you know, he's played at Arsenal. He understands the club. He knows what it will take to get them on board, and he understands the frustration with the fans. For a long time there's been a lot of frustration, and he knows that to get them back on side. But they have got a lot of good attacking players, and they can cause teams problems on their day.
And Stephen, does that really matter? You know what I mean? I know he's picked up his experience in Man City, but to go back as an Arsenal player, no coaching, we've seen it with Man United, with Ole, you know, it can be a poison chalice as well.
Oh, absolutely. What will happen is, you would think he's going to get some grace for the first few games, but he doesn't really need that now. He's hit the ground running to some extent with the win yesterday. But it's whether or not he can show enough about him that he's changing the side's mentality, that he's getting them back to being winning side. And, like, he didn't play for Arsenal when they were this great side. They were still a very good side, but they weren't the Arsenal that we know before, the Invincibles that we all, you know, have enough bad memories playing against them to remember them. So he wasn't part of that Arsenal team, but he does buy himself time, but it's all, only time will tell whether or not he can go on to be a great manager for them, because they'll have to show fundamental changes in the way they play and the way they conduct themselves and the way the players perform on the pitch. They show that they're giving everything for the club and the performance levels, the high energy, and if he can bring that, then that will get them on board and will sustain them for a longer time.
Let's talk about Ole. So when you look at, and a lot of people were looking at his record and comparing it to all the different managers and his win percentage, David Moyes lost 15 times as permanent manager after 53 games. Ole has already beaten that by losing 16 and he's 38.
Yeah, I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. When he was given the job first, he came in and he did extremely well. It was like 10 games unbeaten and they went on an unbelievable run. And I felt he's done a great job. And I thought they should just give it to him at the end of the season. They don't need to give him the job permanently. He's been managing in different leagues. And I understand he was at the in the U team and academy, but he'd never really worked. Like Arteta has worked at Man City in a team that won the league under, you know, getting... He was getting coached by an amazing coach himself, so he was learning tips. So it's a bit different to when Solskjaer came in, even though he's gone off and managed Malmo. It's a totally different ball game, and I know he's played for Manchester United, but I don't know whether he has the credentials to be able to come in and do what Man U do. And the turmoil that Man U are in at the moment is they've dropped off so much that it's a bigger problem almost for Arsenal. Arsenal have been steadily going down this hill, and if they can gradually go back up a step by step, it's different. Man U are looking for an instant fix, and I don't think Dolly's the man for that. It's again, time will tell, but I just don't think he's got enough about him to be able to get them back to the levels they want to be at.
Stephen, you say time will tell, but what do you mean by that? Well, like, is it even the next three games are so important for him?
Yeah, they're huge, and the Champions League is what's vitally important for Manchester United, like, as a club. But realistically, they're looking at Europa League again. That's probably what they're aiming for. And I think he seems to be told he's going to be given to the end of the season. So that's what I'm saying. Will they give him till then? Will they give him this window? Are they going to give him time to spend here? Will Pogba go? There's so many different eventualities that could happen, and it changes the dynamic of how things are going to be. But for me, if he stays till the summer, it's going to be where they finish, who he's brought in, if he's been able to solve the Pogba problem. And for me, did he need to just get rid of him? I think they just need to sell him at this point.
He's probably one of the few people who are thrilled with what's happening with Jose at Spurs, yeah. Because it's taken the attention away from him.
Absolutely, and that's the thing. The fact that he's gone back to, Jose's gone from Man U to Tottenham, he's delighted with what's happening there. But, you know, it's just, football is so fickle. You can be up so high at one point, and Man U have been performing quite well against the top teams. They've always, against Liverpool, against Man City, they've put in good, Chelsea, they've put in good performances this season against the lower teams that they've not done that well, and then they go out and lose to Arsenal. Now the question marks are going to be coming. We can't raise ourselves for a big game. We always thought we could do that. If that's gone now, that, so there'll be more question marks against them.
Yeah, and Marie touched on it there. Spurs losing to Southampton 1-0. Are we starting to see the mask falling with Mourinho a little bit, Stephen?
New Year, same Jose headlines.
I know, same Jose. I know. I think I was quite optimistic when he came in to Tottenham first. I just kind of felt, you know what, if this is like the Jose that came in at Chelsea when he first came in, I kind of thought it's similar sort of time. They're a big club, but they've not really achieved anything. They've got the makings of a good side, but they need to be just tinkered with a little bit to find that form they need to go and win a trophy. Is experienced in that category and he can go in and do it. But now he's getting back to being that sullen sulkiness and, you know, making comments on the sideline. Again, in the Chelsea game when he was talking about Rudiger breaking his ribs and that silliness that he went on, and then yesterday again getting a yellow card. So, you know, the positive Jose seems to have gone, and that's the one I want to see at Tottenham. Like, I'm a Tottenham fan now. I want to see them succeed, and I'd love to see him win a trophy for them. And, you know, with the pedigree he has and with the trophies he's won up to now, there's no one probably better place to go and do it. But I just feel that, you know, Kane being out injured, that's going to be a huge blow for them.
Okay, well, Stephen, will you stay with us? We're going to take a break, but first, it's with great sadness that RTÉ has announced the death of our colleague Marion Finucane. In a statement, RTÉ has said that Radio 1 broadcaster Marion Finucane passed away suddenly today at home. Director General Dee Forbes said, "We learned today of the sudden passing of Marion Finucane with profound shock and sadness. Marion was a broadcaster of immense capability, a household name. She was first and foremost a tenacious journalist with a zeal for breaking new ground. We here at Game On and 2FM would like to echo that tribute and express our sympathies to her family and her friends and colleagues here in RTÉ.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette, new SkinGuard Sensitive Razor. The first razor of its kind designed to stop irritation on sensitive skin. Gillette, the best a man can get.
Game on Rugby.
Okay, to rugby now, and to kick off the new year, we're delighted to be joined by the second best looking second row to emerge from CBC, Cork On and Ireland. Don Lennon, how are you?
I'm thrilled you've reduced yourself to the second best looking. It must be you.
I was being modest. I left out the Babas and the Lions.
Not like you.
Yeah. Donald, we'll kick off, and I must compliment you. I really enjoyed your article to the non-people of Cork in the paper yesterday, the Cork Examiner. You might just tell us about, just a little bit about it. It was your 1986, the Lions tour was cancelled, and you winning a cap at the age of 59.
Yeah, a bit different. Irish Examiner, Donica, let's get it right. We're a national newspaper, just like to point that out to you.
My man would wrap my knuckles.
Yeah, look, it was, I suppose, an unusual story in a way. The 1986 Lions tour to South Africa was cancelled because of apartheid. First Lions tour outside of World War One and World War Two to be cancelled, and of course I was unlucky enough to be around when that happened. But as a result of that, the IRB were celebrating their centenary year in 1986 as well, and it was decided that they'd mark that by the Lions, who, as you know, represent the four home nations, against the other four members of the IRB, who at the time would have been New Zealand, South Africa, Australia and France. So basically the best players from those four countries were lined up to play against the Lions. And when you look at the quality of that, rest of the world side, like you're talking about the best of the All Blacks at the time, along with the likes of Serge Blanco out of France. I mean, they were an incredible lineup. But for whatever reason, in the passage of time, we were always told that game was a Lions test, and it seemed to have been lost in history. And I think it was when your game, the Lions, played against Argentina before they went to New Zealand in 2005. And I think you might have been involved in that game.
Yeah, I played.
And you were involved. Yeah, I mean, there was test caps awarded for that match, despite the fact that Argentina left about 25 fellas at home. So, in effect, you were playing against Argentina C, and they gave you a Lions cap for it. So, at a reunion of that Lions team in 2006, it was decided, look, that really that wrong needed to be righted. It's taken us a long time, but a few of us made presentations to the Lions board this year, and retrospectively they have decided to redesignate the game as a test. So you know, things like that don't generally happen. Certainly, as you say, for me to get a cap at 59 was quite welcome, and in the circumstances certainly meant a lot more. But it was, I suppose, amazing when you look at the passage of time. But the Lions, as you know, is very special. And, you know, with another Lions tour coming up in South Africa, amazing with that itinerary already being announced. The amount of people who've been asking me about, you know, how do you get tickets for the Lions in 2021? I reckon they'll be, for the first time ever, you could have more Lions supporters at a test match than South African. So it just shows where the Lions are, as you know, very special to the players. So look, it was nice. A small bit of history made, I suppose. So yeah, look, it was one of the highlights for me, certainly, of 2019.
Absolutely, and congrats on it. And you mentioned it there. I was actually quite glad the Argentinians rested 20-odd players, because we were lucky to draw with them that day. But you mentioned someone in your article, Nigel Carr. That, it's a special one for him, isn't it, Donal?
Yeah, it is. Nigel was an outstanding wing forward, was on the Irish team. We won the Five Nations, as it was, and the Triple Crown in 1985. We actually drew with France in a real dogfight. When you're talking about what fellas get yellow cards for and red cards, if you ever get a chance, France v Ireland 1985, I think we had three fellas carried off. We had to play at those days, we had to play one of our props, had to cover in the back row, because you'd only five players on the bench. But there was a special group of players. Nigel was picked on that Lions team in 1986. But a year later, he was part selected to go with Ireland to New Zealand and Australia for the first ever Rugby World Cup. We were training in Dublin. He was driving down from Belfast, and the IRA and a remote control bomb assassinated a Lord Chief Justice and his wife in and around Newry. Nigel, unfortunately, with David Irwin and Philip Rainey, who were also in that Irish squad, they were caught in the bomb. Nigel ended up getting badly injured, but he never played a game again. Like, in my view, he would certainly have been in the running to go to Australia with the Lions in 1989, but he never got that opportunity. And you know that Lions game for him was even more special. For him to he was involved in the whole process, but it was, I mean, you know, you talk about I was in Ireland with Ireland as manager, and we toured South Africa in 98, and I remember we played down in Bulland, and this bull of a man came up to me. I wasn't quite sure who he was, because I'd never played against South Africa because of the apartheid era. But this massive man came up to me and said, you're Donal Lenehan. I says, yeah. And I was looking at him, sort of, he looked vaguely familiar. But he said, look, I'm Schalk Burger. I played in the second row for the rest of the world team against you in Cardiff. And of course, immediately we hugged each other. It turns out he's father of Schalk Burger, who would have won a World Cup medal with South Africa in 2007. But for him, you know, it was one of the highlights of his career. So, you know, tis these games, it's only when you get a bit older, they become more special. And I think you'll find out, I've had two or three Lions reunions with different groups, 83, 86, 89, we've all had reunions actually in the last number of years. And you appreciate them more as you get a bit older, because, you know, 10 years on, you kind of say to yourself, ah, look, will I bother going to that? But, with the test of time, they are special. And, you know, in those days you were spending two months or 2.5 months away from home, and you got to know fellas intimately.
And Donal, just on that, like, I know they see this group and our generation being lucky to be professional, but I think you were the lucky ones. Of course, we're lucky to make a living from it, but you had a really special time. You made bonds that will last forever. Whereas we jump up for meals after a match in a tracksuit and barely see those guys again. Whereas there you go, you're embracing people as you walk down the roads of South Africa. Is that something we need to protect within rugby?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think there are times, I've often been with, you know, recently retired players, fellas like Alan Quinlan and those, when we're away, they're in the media now as well. And more times than not, it's people come up to me, people that I would have played against or met on tours over the years. Whereas, as you say, the modern player doesn't seem to have that level of interaction. But I see it, to be honest with you. I see it even at All-Ireland League level. Clubs, they come down, they play a match, they get a bit of grub, a bit of soup and sandwiches or whatever after the game, and immediately they're on the bus. You see one team, it was like the old dance hall long ago. You have one team in one corner and one team in the other, whereas it used to be girls on one side, boys on the other side of the dance hall. No, it's one team on one side of the room and the other team on the other, and they don't even talk to each other. So it's that's that. At club level, so I can imagine what it's like when, you know, you play for Munster, you go over, you play a Pro 14 match. We've all seen them rushing out as fast as they can to get on the charter home to prepare for the next match. But look, that's a product of the game. The amount of games that players are asked to play now, they have to look after themselves. It's all about the minute the game is over, it's recovery and prepare for the next match. So there is a lot lost from that perspective. And certainly it's something that I've noticed, as I say, travelling around the world with some of the lads who played in the professional era, that level of interaction just isn't there.
I'll never forget it. In 2005 on the Lions tour, with Bill Beaumont was the team manager and looked after everything. But he made a speech in every club we went to, and he had brilliant stories about the times he were there. I'll never forget one in Manawatui about an experience of someone being thrown through a window or whatever the crack was. And then the Manawatui club president got up and gave his side of the story, and it was just priceless and just so enjoyable. And like you're saying, a bond that was made forever.
Yeah, it is. And it's amazing when, you know, I noticed now in that 1980 Lions tour that I was on in Australia, I think it was supposed to be a comparatively small tour. It was down to 12 matches, but we were away for 2.5 months. We had a reunion. We've had two reunions, actually, that group. But Fiddley Calder was captain, David Sowell, also ex-Scottish guy. They organised it for London. And it's amazing. You know, you go into the room, you some guys you don't see for years, others you might see a little bit more regularly. But after a couple of hours, you see almost fellas, you know, settling into the company of the guys that they were very friendly with in the tour 25 years earlier. So those bonds, as I say, they do last forever. And it's, you know, it's but it's even more interesting, I think, when you come across players from other countries, particularly down in the Southern Hemisphere. You know, it is special. There's no doubt about it.
Donald Donegal, I could let you talk about the Lions all day long, but there's no getting away from the fact that Leinster beat Munster. You're going to have to talk about it.
Yeah.
Oh, do we have to talk about that?
We were going to go back to the 1953 Lions next, Donald, but no, I suppose it's seen the elephant in the room. I suppose it's been a busy interprovincial season. Leinster are 2-2, Munster and Ulster both a win and a loss, and Connacht have yet to pick anything up on the road. What have you made of the Interpros over the Christmas period?
I've enjoyed them to a degree, but you have to say the outcome of the games is reasonably predictable. Obviously, the managements are curtailed by the fact that the international players, they had to be rested for a full 2 weeks, so that impacted on their selections. Certainly, you could see from an Ulster perspective, I think they've obviously targeted their two home games. They got the reward by beating Connacht in Ravenhill last time out, badly beaten by Leinster with a very young side. But, you know, you look at the team that they've lined up to play against Munster tomorrow night, and again, it's a very strong side. Leinster, you know, we keep saying it every week, it doesn't matter what 15 or what 23 they put out. You know, they seem to be incredibly strong. And again, I was very impressed by them. We did the game, the Munster-Leinster game in Thomond Park on the radio. Conditions were difficult. A gale force wind down the middle of the field, but they were difficult for both teams. But what impressed me most about Leinster is in both halves, either playing with the wind or against the wind, I thought their game management was far superior to Munster's. They had more of an attacking threat playing against the wind when they had to hold on to the ball more. And defensively, they were superb.
I just thought there was an opportunity. When Munster kicked to the corner, it's always a statement. It's kind of saying, you know, we're coming after you. And I know everyone says that, oh, we don't have our top-end players, but if we had, we wouldn't have seen the likes of Will O'Connor, Caelan Doris, Keelan Knox, Jack O'Sullivan. It is a good time to bring in these young fellas and see what they're about.
Yeah, it is. There's no doubt about that. I always love seeing these young fellas getting their opportunity. I think, you know, for some of the selections, it's a question of balancing, bringing in those guys, but keeping a hard core within your squad. Leinster always seem to do that. You know, the fact they had Devon Toner and Scott Fardy in the second row, I think, enabled the two of the players you mentioned there, Will Collars and Caelan Doris in particular. I thought they were outstanding against Munster, but that platform was there for them to perform. Likewise, you know, scrum half, you know,
Osborne.
They had to change just before the game. Ronan Osborne came in. Now, you know me, I've been, yeah. I'm a big fan of the All-Ireland League, have been talking it up for years. And Ronan Osborne is a player, scrum half from Trinity, who I saw play for Trinity 3 times last year, and he really stood out for me. But he was a guy, obviously the competition is such in Leinster that it's very difficult even to get into their sub-academy process. But on the basis of his performances in the All-Ireland League, he was invited into the Leinster setup this year and had a really outstanding game. So, you know, it's brilliant to see these lads getting the opportunity. If I was critical of Munster, I'd say it takes them far longer to give these younger players their opportunity. You mentioned Jack O'Sullivan. Again, he's a young lad that I've been watching for a long time in his days with PBC. Now, to be fair, he did have a cruciate knee injury that put him out for a year, but he was a standout figure with the Ireland 20s. And but again, his opportunities have been limited. He made a massive impact when he came on, as did Kenyon Knox, who's also in the academy at Tighthead, playing for Young Munster. Good to see him getting his opportunity and taking it.
Donica, Graham Rowntree spoke about Jack O'Sullivan afterwards, and it actually reminded me of something that you'd say. They said they've unearthed a real nugget in him.
Yeah, I think they have. Like Donal there, he's a player you've probably been hearing about since Bowen Shield in school, a bit like Keith Earls. There's real excitement about this guy. And I'd agree with Donal. I think we saw enough in him. I was disappointed not to see him start this weekend. I do think we maybe hold players back for that little bit more experience, but I'd be really interested in your take on it. I suppose last year, Donal, we saw the launch of Fineen Witcherly, and we're a year on, and we probably don't know a whole lot more about him.
Yeah, I mean, that is the problem, but for whatever reason, down in Munster, we seem to be that little bit slower to put a bit of trust into these guys. Calvin Nash is a fellow who's been around for the past 2 or 3 years. He's had limited opportunity. You know, you look even at Jeremy Lachman, came in late from the Leinster setup, only got his chance because, like, Dave Kilcoyne had an injury when he came back from the World Cup. Then James Cronin was injured as well. Lachman was thrown in there and ended up man of the match, I think, against the Ospreys in the opening round of the Champions Cup. So, you know, there is opportunities for those guys, and a lot of them. The only worry that I have for a lot of the younger guys is they might wait 5 or 6 weeks to get their opportunity, and they haven't played matches in those terms. Like, they don't tend to play, the A matches are sporadic, they don't play in the All-Ireland League, and as a consequence, you could have a very good player who's, he almost tries too hard, and the fact that he hasn't played a game for a couple of weeks also impacts on his, you know, on him as well. So, look, it's a question of getting the balance right, and that is the challenge, I suppose, for... it's easy for us to be given out on the sideline. There's management teams there who have to get out and earn a win every week. And unfortunately, in rugby, you know, the result is the thing that matters. So coaches at times, looking over their shoulder, they tend to take the shorter term solution, which isn't always the right one.
Yeah, with all those second row injuries, I think we better keep the phone alert for Johan van Graan between the two of us. Surely there's a call up on the cards.
Well,
Donal,
well, at the rate
so
I saw you in one of the, was it Ireland's Fittest Family? The rate I saw you jogging next to one of the families there, I don't think you're in line to get the call up either.
You're not wrong. I have to get into Nick. Yeah, we leave it there. Donal, thanks so much.
Cheers.
Game on, rugby. Game on 2FM. With Gillette, new skin guard sensitive with unique skin guard technology, taking the pressure off the blades and your shave. Say bye to shave irritation. Gillette, the best a man can get.
Peter Wright to win the World Championship, but Michael van Gerwen can't do anything about it.
Well, Peter Wright has missed multiple darts on multiple occasions to beat van Gerwen in a big final. There's no final bigger than this. No title bigger than this. And this time, Peter gets it right. It's all right on the night at the Alexandra Palace.
So last night, Peter Wright beat Michael van Gerwen to win his first PDC world title. And he did it in style, Donica. Style in every sense of the word. His hair, his game, everything.
Don't worry about his hair. What about his pants? Did you see his pants?
Yeah, he's cool.
Honestly, could you see Ruby in a pair of those?
No.
They'd be better than his jodhpurs. Or what? He doesn't like calling them jodhpurs.
No,
he gets out over that.
But I would pay to see him in them, I have to say.
What did you make of the hairstyle? If one of the lads came home and said, "Mom, I want to cut my hair like that,"
one of mine does have a mohawk, so he just hasn't. And he wants to dye it a funny colour. And after watching the darts as well last night, he wants to dye it in a colourful way. Now, we are joined on the line by RTE sports journalist Michael Glennon, who is our darts expert. Michael, what did you make of last night?
Yeah, very good. I was impressed. I have to say, I thought van Gerwen would win it, and I was kind of relieved for Wright. He had lost a lot of finals to Michael van Gerwen, and a lot of finals in the kind of agonising way, and he had lots of chances to win them. So to finally see him get over the line, he's 49 years of age, I was very impressed with it.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing, like, there was, Wright had a good win, of course, but there was a bit of a clash in the semi-final with, what's the Welsh guy's name,
with
Price.
Our old friend, Gerwen Price, yeah. Yeah, and they're actually good friends off the hockey, and, I mean, Gerwen Price doesn't have that many, he's not close to too many people. There was a few things said in the build-up, and it got a little bit heated on stage, And you'd expect a little bit of that, but now they've kissed and made up, or they have been in touch with each other, and it's all good now. But I mean, it's a world semi-final, so emotions were running high on both sides of it.
They didn't shake hands. That was it,
no,
wasn't it?
They didn't shake hands. That goes on every now and again. You'd love to see it in a perfect world, but I suppose there are lots of sports where guys are just not in the humour to hang around after. But you know, they should shake hands.
And on last night's game and the huge win for Peter Wright, Michael van Gerwen looked out of sorts, though.
It's funny, he had the second highest ever losing average for a final, which means he played exceptional. His outshot percentage was higher than his usual outshot, and I know exactly what you're saying. The stats say he played very well, and he did, of course. For some reason, it looked as if he didn't. Some of his visits were very poor. Some of the first starts that hit the board were lower than you would expect, but maybe an inch off target. So it actually, he did play well. It was exceptional final, but for some reason, because of the standards he has set, it looked as if he was off his own form. But we have seen a lot higher averages from him through the years, and he just... and especially in finals, but he didn't deliver it last night at the right times.
We're seeing a change in darts, though, Michael, aren't we? With Fallon Sharrock. Apologies.
Fallon Sharrock obviously had the breakthrough, so she was the first female player to beat or to win a match at the World Championship, and then she repeated defeat. But as good as it is for her, it's actually given a huge boost to the profile of darts. So it's great to have a big breakthrough as well. But she now was in the Sydney Morning Herald, it was on the New York Times. Made everyone sit up and take note. And now she's been rewarded with like five or six events on the World Series, and she's also going to be a Premier League challenger next month.
Michael, we'll have to get you back on to talk more darts now, sure, that the profile has risen because of Fallon Sharrock and females doing brilliant for the sport. But we have to go to news now,
especially
I'm afraid.
On a show, Marie, that's named after a darts expression, like Game On. You know,
Game On.
There we go.
I thought it was from Wayne's World.
But it comes from darts originally, don't it? Happy New Year, guys.
And yeah, you, thanks, nice. Michael. Time for the news.
Bye-bye. Game On 2FM.
Now, welcome back to Game On. Stephen is still with us here in studio and Dunica, and we are going to go to Anfield because John Keith has some team news for us. John?
Yes, I have indeed. Liverpool manager Jurgen Klopp, he makes one change in the team that's bidding tonight for an 18th consecutive home league win, spanning a year, which is amazing if they can do that. He makes one change. Naby Keita is in for Adam Lallana, and in the Sheffield United team, John Lundstram, once an Everton trainee, and David McGoldrick, they're in for Irish forward Callum Robinson and former Everton player Mohamed Bezic. That's the team news from Anfield.
Thanks, John. Stephen, there was a lot of curiosity about what team he would go for. What are your thoughts?
If anything, he's probably strengthened the team, bringing in Keita instead of Lallana. Lallana's a fantastic footballer as well, but I think Keita's just offered a bit more recently. He's starting to find that form, and he breaks into the box really well. He's been scoring crucial goals for them and just offers them a little bit of an extra dimension from midfield. So, you know, he's just full strength side from him again, and they're just going for it.
Donica, I know you have a very interesting stat that you wanted to share about the young Irish footballers who are playing in the Premier League or have made their debut in the Premier League. Do you want to give it to Stephen? And then Stephen has his own interesting story.
That is so sound of you, Marie, because yourself and Ronan Lawler gave it to me. So, Stephen, there's been eight strikers used in the Premiership this season, and four of them have been Irish. It just shows what's to come for Stephen Kelly and his side.
Yeah, no, it's great. And it's what's great for Irish football is, considering all the turmoil we're going through at the moment, if some young players can start breaking into those teams and making a name for themselves in the Premier League, it's fantastic. And, you know, this time of year does offer up a good time for young players to get a chance to start, because games come thick and fast and they pile up and players get injured, and, you know, teams need to be sparingly with their squads, so young players have an opportunity, and they must be doing something right in training week in, week out, to be in the frame of playing, which is great. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to benefit at this time of the year when I made my debut for Tottenham, so it's great.
We were chatting to Don Lennon just before about giving young guys a chance, and is that what we need to do now with these young strikers? Do we need to put them, you know, qualifying games coming up, do we need to give them their head? We need goals.
Yeah, we do need goals, and I think what we need is for him to be performing as well. You need to play football on a regular basis, I think, to be realistically considered in the senior team. And Connolly just goes to show. Connolly came into the fray, scored two goals against Tottenham, and just burst onto the scene really, and was playing quite regularly for Brighton at that time. I think he played, knocked up three or four appearances, and straight away he was bumped into the first team. And that just goes to show that if you do well and you get a run of games in your team, especially in the Premier League, there's every chance you're going to be in your senior squad for him, because, you know, we are lacking goals. It's an opportunity to come and score. And for us, that's that we're crying out for goal scorers. And if you can make a name for yourself as a striker now in the Premier League at a young age, you're going to start for Ireland.
We're going to be watching them now over the next few months as the qualifiers approach him. But tell us about your debut. So you made it around the 28th of December.
Yeah.
You're away on loan. What happened?
Yeah, I was on loan at Watford. I'd been there during the season. We had a break because it was a World Cup that year, under-20s World Cup for Ireland, and it was actually in Abu Dhabi, so it was mid-season, like the Qatar one coming up, so it was like a precursor to that. So we went there for a few months, went back on loan to Watford, and then I got the phone call just before Christmas from Tottenham to say I was going to start on the 28th. They told me about 2 weeks in advance because Stephen Carr was suspended, and they brought me back from Watford on loan, and I sat on the bench for the 26th Stephen's Day game, and then started on the 28th against Charlton, which was amazing. So, at, you know, I was 19 years of age, made my debut in the Premiership, and at that point I think I created a record. I played every division in a calendar year. I think I could be still the only player to do that.
But Stephen, just tell us on that, you know, sometimes people might be resentful about going on loan, you know, how did you see it? Like, I know in rugby guys don't like going on loan. When I was in Worcester, players didn't like going out, they like to be around and try to push to get in the team. But yeah, it's all about playing games.
Yeah, it was imperative to my development as a player to go out on loan. Like, absolutely made me what I was, and created a platform for me to get into the Tottenham first team and show I was good enough, because you're going off and it's one thing training with the first team and playing underage football, but you're playing against kids. You're not playing against men. You go and play against men and it's a total different ball game. My first game in the league, I went on loan to Southend, it was League 2 at the time, broke my nose, playing centre back, horrible game, 1-1-0, came after it, and I was like, oh my gosh, what a baptism of fire. But it's those things that stand against you, and you go and you build on them, and then when you play lower leagues and you're at a massive club like Tottenham, it makes you want to stay at Tottenham. It makes you realise how good you have it, and that, you know, I'm going to do everything I can to break into the first team there. So for me, it was fantastic. And I think for the young players now, if you're not getting game time at your club, going on loan is hugely important.
I'm shocked. Still that good looking with a broken nose.
Six times I've done it, Donica. Six
no
times.
No way!
Yes.
Jeez.
Had it fixed on the side of a pitch with a spoon once in Ireland. Yep.
No way, how did I do that?
Just use a spoon to crack it and push it back across. Old school technique.
Have you broken yours, Donegan?
Oh, yeah, I did break mine, but I'm not as good looking as Stephen.
Stephen, just on that, we were talking about players and potentially the benefits of going on loan. You're a Spurs fan, former Spurs player. We can't not mention Troy Parrott. What do you think would be best for him?
It's hard to say, and especially with Mourinho, he's not known for playing young players week in, week out. He likes tried and tested, and he likes to bring in, you know, proven players. And you definitely feel, well, Harry Kane getting injured, this is an absolute opportunity for him to go into the market and bring in a striker, because they don't have a proven striker that sits behind Kane. They have Moura's son who fills in for him, but they don't have a striker, which is what he likes to have. And I don't think he would put Troy as the instant replacement for Kane. I think he's probably an intermediary for him. So for me, I don't think he's going to be able to go on loan, not this time, unless they bring in two or three, because he will get game time, especially if Kane is injured. He'll be bumped up the list, but he could do with playing. If he could get game time, for me, going out on loan, it'd be amazing for him. You know, you have to realise he is behind arguably one of the best strikers in the world, so for him to displace Harry Kane is going to be extremely hard to do. So if he needs to go somewhere else to get game time, then so be it. But it would only benefit him, especially if he goes to a decent standard.
But Stephen, you know better than anyone, sometimes injuries, they're opportunities for guys. And is this one for him now, with Harry Kane picking up that hamstring injury? Could he take this opportunity?
Yeah, absolutely. But it's only an opportunity if you're given the opportunity, isn't it? If he's... So at the moment, Kane went off injured, but Troy wouldn't have been on the bench to come on to replace Kane. They would have saw someone else as filling in that position. Like I said, Son or Moura are the ones that automatically go up there, even though they're not really a number nine. They're more of an attack-minded midfield player or a winger. They'll start him up front automatically. But yeah, you're right. An opportunity for me, Stephen Carr was suspended and I got my chance to start a fullback because they saw me as direct replacement for him. I don't think he's seen as a direct replacement for Harry Kane yet, and that's where the issue lies. If he was, I'd be saying all out, stay there. I can't see them letting him go, not now, but you know, in the future, if he needs game time, it'd be imperative that he plays for his development, to play against men all the time. And he's more than capable. The games I've seen him play, especially for Ireland, he didn't look out of place at all. He's more than capable of playing at that level.
Tell me, just because maybe there's a big difference between rugby and soccer, but in the weeks leading up to it, if there was an opportunity there with someone picking up an injury and someone trains really well, does that, like, that crossover sports? Like, can he train brilliantly, impress Mourinho in training and put his hand up to be included?
Yeah, you think he can. And for, depends on what type. I've never worked with Mourinho before. I don't know him in that sense and how he does. So for me and a lot of managers I've worked with, you can train, some of them, you can train as hard and as good as you want and you still won't play, just depending on the manager. I don't know why that is, but that's the way some managers operate. Other managers only pick you based on the way you train, and if you train well, you'll probably start. So I'm not sure what type of manager Mourinho is. I'm sure though Troy will be doing his utmost and training, you know, every day extremely hard. And I've been around the training ground, I've been back down to Tottenham and spoke to the staff around there, and they've told me that he's really hard working and dedicated. So, you know, it's only going to stand to him. It just depends on what Mourinho's thinking, and if Mourinho sees this as an opportunity, he's often done it, not played a striker, not played a player to make a point to the board that he brings in a player. And as much as that, you know, that won't benefit Troy, that's the type of manager Mourinho is, and we've seen that in the past. So I'm hoping he gets a chance, and with Kane being injured, it's a great opportunity for him, because if he came in and scored a goal, it'd be amazing, because that would give him the confidence to go on and play more.
Wouldn't it be great to see him get some game time before the playoffs, because he could benefit us so much. Stephen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Marie. Thanks, Annika.
Right, we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to have our Thursday topic on goal setting.
2FM.
Game on. On 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. Marie, every Thursday we like to do our Thursday topic, and this one is no different. I think it's quite apt for the new year, new you. We're going to chat about goal setting, and we're delighted to be joined by Daniel Davey and Austin O'Malley. Lads, how are you doing?
How are you doing, Dunners?
Great. Yes, good time for us.
So what we normally do for our Thursday topic is maybe go around the room and I'll kick us off, Donal O'Callaghan. I've been lucky enough to be involved in professional sports, so have always set goals, but since I retired I actually find it hard because there's a lack of accountability or maybe repercussions for setting them. So I've struggled with it. But something I have done just before the new year, and looking forward to getting back on the horse and pushing on.
So what are your goals? You didn't tell me.
Quite private. I want to get back in Nick is another one. I spent.
You're going to shred, are you?
Not shred. Do you know what? I'm going to train for vanity. Austin, okay, you know all about that. You're
I've
the vainest
seen you,
man
yes,
I know.
I've seen you. Yeah, I've seen the beach weights are out and the corals are going again.
There's a bit of a problem, though, is the amount of food you eat, but we'll go into that in a little while. So while we're going around the table, my name is Marie, and yesterday I did 91 steps, so that'll tell you where I need to go.
Super.
The two lads are grimacing here. Daniel, tell us about yourself.
Yeah, so I work mainly in elite sports, rugby and GAA. I work with, I suppose, other athletes as well in golf and athletics. And my goal setting and the work I do is mainly around nutrition, lifestyle. It's probably expanded a good bit into behaviour change. So perfect for this evening's conversation.
Yeah, definitely. Austin?
Yeah, obviously I'm working as a performance coach with McNulty at the moment, and again I suppose I would be executing across different crucibles in terms of corporate, pro sport, and again would be looking at a lot around, I suppose, setting goals and goal setting with athletes, corporate populations, and also amateur sports people.
So goal setting.
Yeah.
Who wants to take it up? Where do we start? Austin?
Yeah, I think, obviously, I think and Donica made a really great point there, that this time of year is brilliant with regard to, I suppose, reflecting. I think as a society, we're probably caught up in kind of the soup of life and we're constantly executing. And I think this time of year is fantastic to sit down and actually take stock. And those days, I think, between sort of the 25th of December and the 31st are gold dust with regard to that, to actually sit down, get a really clear focus for what's coming in the year ahead, and to get clarity around things you want to achieve. And by setting goals, goals. I suppose we often refer to it as they're more or less like, I suppose, the North Star that you kind of, you know, adjust your compass towards. So it's really, really important that we establish those early on and get clear about them. So we would regard those as kind of outcome goals. But I think for me, and in the space I work on, the most important thing really is the performance and the process goals that kind of that ride shotgun to those. And those are the daily rituals that support that or kind of create that footbridge for you to get to your outcome in the end.
And Austin, it just on that, so if you're sitting down to set goals, maybe you've never done it before, what's the basic advice you'd give to someone that's just maybe listening to the car? They want to set little targets for themselves or achieve big things. What are the golden rules to goal setting?
I suppose the golden rules and the old ones are, I suppose, you know, that go back to setting SMART goals and that. But I would probably shift the dial on that, and I would say that if you are sitting down setting goals, they must be aligned with your purpose and your passion, and connected to your, I suppose, you know, we often say it's your raison d'etre or your purpose in life. And generally, if you set goals, which I call passion goals, it's a lot easier to stay on track, and it's a lot easier to live up to the daily rituals and the, I suppose, the metrics that you'd use to measure those along the way there. So it's very important to sit down, get clear, to set that outcome, and then to realise that it's generally the behaviours and the habits that sustain you across, whether it's the day, week, month, up to those then. So it's get clear, set goals that are going to stretch you, but they're achievable, keep them time bound, and then look at your behaviours and your habits, your daily behaviours and habits, that again, I suppose I've said, would create the footpath or the footbridge towards that outcome in the end.
So Daniel, on that, what Austin is chatting about in terms of SMART goal is it specific, measurable, attainable, relevant and time bound, isn't it?
I think it's kind of interesting. I would still use that kind of approach within an elite environment and find it really useful. So obviously, as you well know, the season is split up. You've got your off season, you've got your pre-season, and then your in season, and that gives a lot of structure. Athletes like structure, and then you're breaking it down into your weeks and your days. And I find that is a really good reference when I'm working with athletes that are maybe don't have that structure and that accountability that you talked about. Because one of the big mistakes that I see people making is not being specific enough. So in general conversation, people say, well, I want to be fitter, or I want to improve my nutrition, but they're not being specific. So it's, from my perspective, it's about drilling into it. What within nutrition do you really need to improve? Is it your cooking skills? Is it your hydration? Are you prepping food? Are you eating too late? What are the specific things that you can do that can improve your the behaviors around nutrition? And that makes it a little bit easier, a little bit more tangible. So it's specific, and then I think, and it'll obviously come up as we're discussing it, is then how are you measuring it? What's your reference point? Well, from a cooking point of view, it could be as simple as taste. Is it actually tasting better? Is the food that you're eating, is it a better experience? So, like, I guess having worked in an elite sport for quite a number of years, it goals can be still really simple. Like one of the goals that I'm working with now with an athlete at the moment is learning how to use spices with their food. They can do the basics, but what about combining different types of spices to bring, obviously you're going to bring more nutrition value, but if you're enjoying it and there's a fun element to it, it's a more positive experience. That goes back to what Austin's saying, you're more likely to stick to it.
Sounds hard though. Like what if you fall off the wagon? Like after one day, not that I did because I just started today, but after my 91 steps, like how do you get back on it?
Well, I'll just say very quickly that's all relevant to how big of the task is that you're setting yourself, because it has to be attainable. If you're setting yourself at a goal of, let's say, you know, you said 90 steps.
91.
Twice 91. Are you just on the couch all day? Or?
Oh, yeah, well, there was loads of football on yesterday and the darts. There was 9 games on.
But you anchored. Maybe you did 20,000 the day before.
I did not.
But, you know, be realistic. Set yourself a realistic goal that, I mean, is it bringing lunch one day a week? Is it getting out and doing 5,000 steps? Do you know what I mean? Is it doing 10 minutes of activity on one day a week?
I definitely go from like 91 steps to, right, I'm going to run a marathon in 2 weeks' time and I'm going to eat really healthy. I think, like, you're right, it's too much.
Yeah, no, I would concur. Like, you have to be realistic and it has to be relevant. But I suppose when I sit down with, whether it's an amateur athlete or whether it's someone in a corporate environment and they go to goal set, there's, you know, we look at kind of a holistic evaluation on the person as well, because you have to realize that some people do not have the capacity with regard to the goals they set sometimes. So again, it goes back to that, you're getting very clear about what you actually want to achieve and how that is aligned to your purpose. So what work are you doing on yourself, I suppose, at a behavioral level, in terms of if you're setting those outcome goals but you don't have behaviors to sustain and support that, well then that's unrealistic. So maybe I've always said that it's not actually the goal, but it's actually the systems and processes that you put in place around that that actually bring you along that journey. So rather than looking at the end point, come back and just say, the daily ritual, are the behaviors there and the habits, you know, there's an old quote there, it's not choices but habits rule the unreflecting flock. I think it was by Wordsworth or someone. But if you think of that in terms of behaviors and habits, those are the things that need the analysis. So maybe, Marie, you need to look at your behaviors and your habits.
Austin, I think that's the greatest thing, though. Like, for me, being a professional athlete was easy. Everything was monitored, everything was put on for you. It isn't since I maybe transitioned away from rugby that I'm realizing it's incredibly hard. Even just small things, we spoke about it before, Marie, just trying to get physio times. Whereas when you're in a professional environment, it's really easy. And the biggest area, and Daniel, maybe you might be able to help me, is measurement. That's where I'm really struggling, because you know better than anyone, every 3 months you were DEXA scanned, every couple of weeks you were skin folded. How do people measure, maybe a good way of, you know, an easy way of keeping an eye on body composition without the expense of things like a DEXA scan?
Yeah, I actually going to pick up on one thing before I go on to the measurement. And you know, you mentioned transitioning out of sport. I think, can I ask you, do you speak to anybody about your training at all? Do you have a trainer? Do you have a gym buddy?
I train with a few of the lads still, but that is really kind of sporadic when we're around each other. I do chat to a fair few of my old strength and conditioning coach, but the big thing is ownership. Mm. And I was a great man for maybe pushing the programs and studying it, whereas now I'm probably not as effective at knocking on the door and you having someone that probably is in charge of it, which is myself.
Yeah, so I think if I'm going to pick up maybe Asti's point on purpose, and I think priority is probably comes into it too. How far do you want to go? What do you want to achieve? And why, I guess, are you doing it are really important when you look at the measurement element. So like you said, you can still actually get access to things like DEXA. There are still good things like, I mean, it's not going to be as good as a DEXA, but it'll give you some measurement, and that is the Tanita scale and things like that, which are more accessible now. So it's about how far you want to go, but an awful lot of people won't have access to that. They'll have to go to their local gym, there'll be personal trainers, and then it's really, really personal. Like, some people can measure, I know this might be a good reference for you, but measure off their clothes and how they fit, and even how they look in the mirror is a reference point. So if you break it down and say, okay, how specific do you want to be? You know, are you doing it because you want to know exactly how much muscle mass you're going to gain or how much fat mass you're going to lose? Or are you doing it for general wellness and fitness? So you do have to be specific about that. But if you just want a general measurement, then getting or working with a professional, and it doesn't have to be, you know, a big major financial commitment, but someone that'll do measurements for you, even, you know, your girth measurements and just very simple tape measurements and weight will give you a guide, and then you are going to go back to how you look and feel.
Yeah, And then if we move on from measurement, lads, and look at attainable, like, I don't like being harsh on Marie, but I don't see you running the marathon in the next 2 weeks. So how do you make a goal attainable? How, help us there.
I think, again, going back to what we spoke, that, you know, the, just going back to the measurement piece of it there, that, you set small measures or little KPIs, and I think it comes back maybe to most people, you need to set, or you need to be able to build like a little performance development plan for yourself. And that's very, very simple in terms of having your stated goal. What are the actions I need and required to reach them? Have a key a KPI in there. So if it's someone that wants to drop a little bit of weight, you know, measure that by scales every second week, or again, going back to if it's your clothes you're taking, and then look at maybe what are the resources required also that you need in your environment to get you to there, and then what are the enablers and the derailers along the route as well, because it's very, very important that we understand that there are people in our environment that will set us up for success, but there are also people and things in our environment that we can't control that will derail us, you know, with regard to us actually achieving what we want to achieve. So for things to be attainable, you need to get, again, have certain specificity around it, but also those small measures. And they, as I said previously, they don't have to be expensive things. You know, use things that are in your environment.
Daniel, I'm terrible for any fad, like anything going. Like I'd say I downloaded about 5 apps in the last day. MyFitnessPal, Body Fast, Map My Run, and a few more there as well. Like, how wary should I be of all these different things that are kind of coming into my social media and sucking me in and telling me that they can get me fit and healthy?
Extremely. Probably at this time of year, you're probably better picking one or two resources and sticking to them, and even if it's people who you know you're going to get trustworthy information, just sticking to those, because you can be pulled left, right and center, and then what'll happen, you'll make no progress at all. I think we often forget how simple the whole element of wellness is. And we do get lost in a, you know, seeking something that is going to give us really, really fast progress. Juice diets and, you know, going vegan for January and all of these things. And the core to my principles is always about what can be sustained. What are you going to do now that you're going to do in 6 months, 12 months, 2 years' time? That's my entire focus. I think it's a really good time, as Asti says, for reflection and actually looking and seeing what is it within your lifestyle that needs the greatest level of change. Be specific. You know, maybe it isn't nutrition. Maybe it's actually you need better sleep quality, investment in time in that, or it's exercise. So it's really specific to it. Be specific about your resources as well. If it's nutrition resources, make sure it's, you know, qualified nutritionist, dietitian, and from an exercise.
So the influencers
point of view,
stay away from them.
Well, yeah, no comment. We've got key pillars. We've got exercise. We've got sleep. We've got stress management, and we've got nutrition. And we need to reflect and be specific about which one of them needs our attention. You know, are you getting enough fruit and vegetable? Are you being fruit and vegetables each day? Are you being hydrated? Are you getting enough exercise? What is it specifically to you? Because I think if you just go, it's nutrition and it's not nutrition, then that'll fall off. You know, that'll be the thing that you don't actually, it becomes less important.
I'm going to pick you up on something that's a little bit off topic. You mentioned there about going vegan for January. For Christmas dinner, we sat down with 4 sisters, and 2 of my brothers-in-law are gone vegetarian. Is this the new fad?
No. Being a vegetarian is most definitely not a fad, or being a vegan isn't a fad either.
They watch Game Changers now on Netflix. For anyone who hasn't seen it, it's about being going vegan, and there's lots of top athletes who have gone vegan, and they are talking about the virtues of it.
Don't be drawing any attention to it, please.
Not a fan, Dan.
I'm not a fan. It's not based on any sound science whatsoever. It's all cherry picked. Anyway, I don't really want to talk about it. But there's great value in adding more vegetables to your diet. There's no question. but I always, it's no more than doing more exercise or whatever it might be within your health goals. Reflect first. Are you getting enough fruit and vegetables? Rather than saying, I'm going to commit to a vegan diet or a vegetarian diet, try and improve the diet that you've committed to now. And again, it's just about working on the small. I thought some of the things that Austin mentioned there about your performance plan, that's exactly what we do within our athlete environment. We look at the whole athlete's profile, every aspect, and we see what's your priority right now, what's red, what's green, what's orange, what needs to be focused on.
Well, I'm definitely going to pick you up again on the game changers and being vegan, because
it's a whole different show.
Yeah, it's a whole different show. But three in top intercounty players that I've heard of over the last few weeks have gone vegan. So that in the next few weeks, I want to get you back in for that.
Don't
go vegan.
Watch the space.
That'll get us back on track here. Hopefully,
tell you what.
Tell us, like, I'm just going back to goal setting when we used to do it in a team environment. And I remember we'd always say, as soon as we'd sit down, win the European Cup, win whatever it was, the Celtic League or whatever it was known at the time. But it wasn't until Doug Hola came in and started looking for measurement of it. So he's there, how do we exactly do that? Before that, we just hoped it would happen. But he sat back with us and broke it down that we need to have 16 points tallied up before Christmas, and really broke it all down into kind of measurable, accountable parts. How important is that for any goal, Austin?
Oh no, I think it's cardinal to the whole success of it. And I think what kind of rides along that as well is those KBIs, not KPIs, but your key behavioural indicators that support you know, the measurements of that in terms of your standards of excellence in that. And it's interesting that you say that with Dougie, obviously a guy that has executed across, different high performance environments. Those are paramount, that you have some element of measure in there, but the behaviours and the standards of excellence, again, and I keep going back to it, those are your systems that allow you to, from a performance perspective, we would say that make the boat go faster, that everybody is locked in and that everybody is showing those observable winning behaviours.
Can you explain those KBIs to us, Austin?
Yeah, so I would often refer to these as observable winning behaviours. So if you take it from a sports performance perspective, that within your culture, there are certain standards of excellence that you have built in, and everybody is expected to measure up to those. So those are simple things like, you know, being there 15 minutes pre-training, that you arrive hydrated, that your nutrition is nailed on, that you do your recovery. All of these things that we say are the one percenters, but they all lead and I suppose point to the top of the mountain, for want of a better word. So it's about, again, going back to the system. You know, we become overly focused sometimes on the goal, and it can seem to be like, you know, a straitjacket or to shackle. You've got to immerse yourself in the daily rituals and love the process. That's what it's all about. And those behaviours that fall out of that and support that then.
Austin, what I loved about it was when you achieved a small goal, you got a lift from doing it. So when you actually did hit 15 points before Christmas, it lifted the whole squad, and you knew you were on track, as opposed to nearly just hoping it happens.
Yeah, well, that's the key thing with measurement again. And we need to realise that by immersing ourselves in the system and hitting those, you know, quarterly measurements, if it's from a company perspective or if it's a points tally from a professional sports perspective, that there's a great sense of enjoyment and a great sense of fulfillment, and it gives guys confidence then to go again. So they feed into the, I suppose, the wider picture and the wider performance plan.
Donica, just very quickly, I think that the sharing element is really critical, and that's why I asked you about the training partner. Mm-hmm. Because we're very fortunate when we're involved in sport to be surrounded with high achievers, and even walking into an environment, you meet somebody that's going to help to motivate you. And I think that it's really important to seek out those type of people and identify people within your space, friends, family, parents, whoever it might be, that will actually help to lend you support on this, because very often it's very difficult if you're trying to do it alone. And I would have found, even I'm not playing Gaelic football anymore, but I've got some friends who, you know, they've stopped playing maybe a year or two, and I've contacted them, and, you know, we go hill running and whatever it might be, and we're setting up some, you know, to take part in some adventure races or whatever it might be later this year. But I think that get your resources right, journal. So actually go out and buy something that you can write these little notes down in. Use what Austin is saying about being specific and creating a little plan that's very personal to you, because I think that's a big problem. I think very often with social media or print media, we're looking what other people are doing, and we're not, I think it's a big issue, we're not looking at our own behaviours sufficiently enough. So create that, and then try and create the experience, because if it isn't a fun, enjoyable experience that's shared, then it's far harder to sustain it. And again, I'll keep going back to that sustainability element.
Yeah, the biggest area I find in that, and you're right, I miss that group environment and the training buddies, but I also miss that accountability factor. To, you know, just even in small things, that if we said we were going to do something, that we did it. And I think it's a massive point, Daniel. And how do you go about finding someone like that, a good training buddy, someone to be accountable to?
Well, I think you need to step up outside your comfort zone very often. It's not an easy thing to do, but start with it being a conversation. So I have people who are still involved in sport at a high level. I've got friends who aren't. And I actually will ring them and ask them what have they doing or what have they've done. And like, we can do video call and video message and all of this, Snapchat, whatever. We are very accessible now. We can have that contact. And it is about getting that person to return it. And all it sometimes needs to be is a phone call or a text message from somebody at the end of a week. What did you do this week? This is what I've done. And because there's a lot of, I suppose, there's positive and negatives with things like apps and trackers and, you know, Fitbits and Apple Watches and things like that. But it does provide us with some element of what we would call outer accountability. And I think it's how we use that information and share that information that provides us, again, when you're not in the elite environment, with some form of measurement and accountability.
Daniel Austin, thanks for joining us. You might come back in a month and check up how we're doing, Donica in particular. See if he'll be ripped in a month's time.
I'm looking forward to your marathon in a week.
Superwoman.
Yeah, right, guys, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with American Sport. FM.
Game on, Iron America. Okay, time to wipe away the January blues, because we're turning stateside and all the attention turns to the NFL playoffs, which begin this weekend. We're joined by our favourite American. No, not Michelle Obama. It's Jeff Shepherd. Jeff, how are you?
Well, I look just as good in dresses. I'm doing great, guys. I'm back from a wonderful Christmas and New Year holiday. And, yeah, getting ready for the playoffs this weekend. It's going to be a lot of fun. We got two games each on Saturday and Sunday. First game's up on Saturday. All the AFC's playing on Saturday. You got the Buffalo Bills and the Houston Texans in game one. And I just, Buffalo is one of those teams that I'm not really a big fan of theirs. I mean, it's no big deal, but it just always seems better to me when Buffalo's involved in the playoffs. Their fans are insane. You could go down a YouTube rabbit hole of the crazy things that their fans do in the parking lot. I think y'all might enjoy that. Some very serious hooligan-like activity that happens there. And then the evening game on Saturday night, you've got the New England Patriots playing in the wild card round against the Tennessee Titans, and one of their former players, Mike Vrabel, is the head coach at the Titans. So it's interesting to kind of have the Patriots, you know, who've just been so good for so long. You know, we've talked about them for, you know, two decades now with this Brady and Belichick era, and they're playing a wild card game. It feels like it's been a very long time since they played in the wild card round.
Okay, I'm going to embarrass myself because I know Marie's up to speed with NFL and the way it works, but can you explain the wild cards to me?
Absolutely. So you have six teams make the playoffs, okay? And you have four division winners, and then you have two wild card teams. And so and let's take the AFC. The Ravens are the one seed, and the Chiefs are the two seed. So not only do they win their division, but they get a bye in the first round of the playoffs. And so the three seed is the Patriots. The four seed would be the Texans. They get home games in the wild card round. And then the five seed would be the Titans, and the six would be the Bills, I guess is how it worked out. So I think I had my math correct there. And so the wild card teams travel to the division winners that don't get byes. And then so they'll play, and then next week the Ravens, by being the number one seed, by virtue of that, will play the highest remaining seed still available. So if, you know, the 5 or the 6 team would win, that team would go play in Baltimore, and then the other team would go play the Chiefs. And so that's kind of how it works out. So you don't have to win your division to make the playoffs. They pick the 2 best teams that also qualify for the playoffs. The teams with the 2 best records make it in as wild cards. And then so conversely, on Sunday, you've got the NFC games. You've got the Saints, who won the NFC South and finished 3rd. They're going to play the Vikings. And then you've got the Seattle Seahawks, or the wild card team. They're going to travel to Philadelphia. And we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. You know, the winner of the NFC East, you know, not really having a great record. Seattle's actually got a better record, but they didn't win their division. So they're a wild card in that matchup. They're going to go on the road to Philadelphia.
It's like the back door with GA. Is that it, Murray?
Kind of. Shep, just going on to the Patriots there, considering it's such unfamiliar territory for them, how do you expect them to fare?
So, look, I mean, you know, they lost, you know, just a couple of games during the regular season, you know, to the Ravens and to the Texans, and kind of, you know, a little bit of a shocker at the end of the year against the Dolphins. They have, as much as you can build your team to play and play well in January, that is kind of what they have done. I mean, think about, you know, Tom Brady's, you know, older than 40 years old, and where they've been in 3 of the last 4 Super Bowls, and they've won a couple of them. I mean, so, you know, they have figured out the formula for getting your team and your bodies ready to play, you know, outdoors, cold weather football, you know, in the Northeast in the month of January to prepare you for the Super Bowl. So, I think the Titans will give them a tough matchup early on, but I think in the end, New England is just going to wind up pulling away. And look, I mean, this isn't one of their best teams that they've had in you know, this long run, but they've got Tom Brady, and I mean, he's got 6 Super Bowls, and he knows how to win a football game.
But Chip, just on that, like, you're right, he is 42 years of age, 20 seasons in it. He might get caught on this wild card one, but surely playing more games runs the risk of injuries. Like, they don't really want to be in these wild cards, do they?
No, exactly right. I mean, and that's the thing, Donners. You know, the other teams are all getting to rest their players. I mean, you know, the way that sports medicine works nowadays, and the way that these guys' bodies heal, I mean, in 2 weeks, you can really get a whole lot healthier. And so, I mean, there is a significant advantage to being the 1 or the 2 seed and having that bye, which is, I mean, and look, in the NFC, it didn't come down to almost the final play of the season on last Sunday night's games with Seattle and San Francisco. Seattle, you know, San Francisco winning the game late. They got the 1 seed. I mean, that, again, you're looking at an extra week off, resting, practicing, you know, scouting, film review, all that different stuff, and it is a definite decided advantage. And if you're the 1 seed, you get home field advantage throughout the playoffs. You don't have to travel.
Shep, we haven't spoken to you since Black Monday because it's just gone, and we know that after the regular season, it's when we see a lot of managers depart. Who are the most significant casualties of the one just gone?
So the Redskins, you know, fired their coach, Jay Gruden, and have hired already Ron Rivera. He was the coach at the Carolina Panthers. And look, he was a successful coach. I think he was 76-63 was his record. They were not very good this year because Cam Newton got hurt, and I think this was the 2nd year in a row that they hadn't made the playoffs. But, I mean, you know, he was on the market, right, you know, I mean, for about as short of a time period as you could be. I think they're making the announcement today, I believe, or they made it yesterday, that he's officially – I mean, it's already official. They signed him. They're just going to do the introduction. So you've still got the New York Giants job that's still open. And so the appealing thing there is, A, it is New York, but you've got a young quarterback in Daniel Jones. You've got a really good young running back in Saquon Barkley. So you've got some pieces there. Eli Manning is going to be retired. And then you've got the Panthers job that's open, obviously, because Rivera's not there. And then you have the Cleveland Browns. They went ahead and they decided to fire Freddie Kitchens, after 1 year, which typically doesn't happen in the NFL. I mean, unless it's an absolute disaster. But they just didn't like the course of what was going on in the locker room with the team and just some of the decisions that were made. So they cut bait early with him. You know, they were the kind of the glamour pick in the offseason to be the surprise team in the NFL with Baker Mayfield and Odell Beckham Jr. and Jarvis Landry and Nick Chubb and all these offensive weapons. And I think they won 6 games and they lost their last 3. So they just really, really underperformed the expectations.
Shep,
and so,
are you?
They have an opening as well.
Yeah, Shep, as a coach or a president, are you safe if you survive Black Monday, or could this, you know, will the axe fall for a few more before we get going?
No, I mean, it's typically either the Monday or the Tuesday. I mean, for instance, the Jacksonville Jaguars were rumored to potentially be moving on from Doug Marrone. But the owner, Shad Khan, came out and he said, I don't feel like this is the right time to make that choice. And he did that on Tuesday. Now, the last shoe that we're waiting to fall and see what happens here is, what do the Dallas Cowboys do? Again, we've already talked about this, you know, a couple of times over the last couple of weeks. Jerry Jones is, you know, a very loud, vocal owner, and he's not saying anything right now. He's met with Jason Garrett. Jason Garrett's met with the team, but they have not made or they haven't publicly announced anything with regards to a decision there. That would be obviously a huge job. I mean, that is, you know, quote unquote, Dallas is America's team, you know, from their success in the 70s and in the 90s as well. I mean, that's a big, big job. I think it would be stunning if Jason Garrett comes back. I mean, they have underachieved. They again didn't make the playoffs this year. I think the writing's on the wall that he is not going to be brought back. And they're potentially looking at maybe some coaches in college to elevate and move into that position. But that's the big job that we're still waiting to see. And it may not be another week or two before that decision's made. But it's typically made within the first 48 hours of the season coming to an end.
Shep, we know you're a huge college football fan, and the national championship game is set. LSU will play Clemson on January 13. Two great teams, two great quarterbacks as well. It should be a fantastic game.
Absolutely. My LSU Tigers beat Oklahoma in the national semifinals. I was fortunate enough that the Shepherd family loaded up the old station wagon and drove over to Atlanta. It's only about 6 or 7 hours away from where we live. And I actually got to go to the game with my oldest son. It was fantastic. And then later that night, Clemson beat Ohio State out in the Phoenix, Arizona area. So Clemson's back in the national championship. I think this is the third year in a row, maybe the fourth year in a row. I mean, they've just had a phenomenal program. They beat Alabama twice, and they lost to Alabama once, and so now they'll play LSU. They're going to play that game in New Orleans in a couple of weeks on the 13th, and, you know, New Orleans and Baton Rouge are only about 9 miles apart, so it's going to be a wild, wild scene in the city. But Joe Burrow, LSU's quarterback, you know, won Heisman against Trevor Lawrence, who is Clemson's phenomenal quarterback. And it's going to be a great football game. They're going to be, if you're a fan of the NFL, but you haven't ever really gotten into college football, if you watch this game, there's going to be probably 15 or 20 future NFL players on the field for both teams.
Well, so it's a brilliant game to watch for seeing the next kind of grassroots level.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the last couple of years with Clemson and Alabama, they have put so many guys in the NFL that are already contributing to teams, and I think that's going to be the case again in this year's national championship.
Shep, give us a Shep top tip there to keep an eye out for, someone that you think is going to light it up.
Well, so, I mean, I'll stick with, you know, with my team, and a guy that didn't really play too much in the national semifinal against Oklahoma, the LSU starting running back, his name is Clyde Edwards-Helaire, and he's battling a hamstring injury. And the Tigers, you know, beat Oklahoma so badly, they didn't really need him. I think he only played 5 or 6 snaps in the game, and they were still able to score 63 points. They're going to get him back out there, and I think he's going to be a very valuable weapon for LSU as they try to attack that Clemson defense.
Shep, it was a sad day yesterday when former NBA Commissioner David Stern passed away. He helped turn the league into a global phenomenon in the 1980s. We're just going to hear his last draft.
With the 30th pick in the 2013 NBA Draft, the Phoenix Suns select Nemanja Nedović. from Belgrade, Serbia. He last played for Lake Tuvos, Rytas in Lithuania. This concludes the first round, my 30th first round, which is approximately 900 picks. And I want to thank the fans here in Barclays Center for your hospitality and enthusiasm. And let me say what a privilege it's been to do this for the last 30 years and to welcome the tremendous young men. So I'd like you to join me in welcoming the NBA Deputy Commissioner and the next Commissioner of the NBA, Adam Silver, who will conduct the second round of the 2013 NBA Draft.
Shep, an amazing man, not only transformed the game within the States, but really made it global.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, think about how many players now that are from Eastern Europe or from, you know, the continent of Africa that weren't ever really, you know, available in NBA drafts. I mean, you know, Yao Ming in China. I mean, they've had players from all over, you know, all of the folks from South America. You know, obviously, you know, it helped, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, kind of when David Stern was taken over, when you had players like, you know, Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, Dr. J, and then Michael Jordan comes onto the scene. I mean, you know, you didn't have to do a lot, you know, for the guys, you know, to kind of market themselves. You know, you had the rise of Nike and all of the things that came with that. But David Stern, you know, was really responsible. He was big on, you know, the foreign influence, spreading the NBA out around the world. There's fans all over the world of the game of basketball. You know, that's one of the things that they say, all you need is a ball and a hoop, and you can go out there and you can go play. And there were fans all over the world. And you look at it now, I mean, it really is, you know, you've got soccer and basketball. I mean, those sports are known the world over. And a lot of that with regards to basketball is due to the work that David Stern did in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, Shep, we're tight on time. Thanks so much. I know we're cheering for LSU in a few weeks, but it's the Saints this weekend. We wish you luck. Thanks for joining us.
Appreciate it, guys. The man open,
Game on, Iron America.
Now that was Jeff Shepherd there with all our sports from America. There is some breaking news from Anfield. Naby Keita has picked up an injury in the warm-up, so James Milner goes in instead of him. So a little bit of a change there for Liverpool. So Donica, we're nearly at the end of our first show back.
Yeah, been a busy one. I enjoyed the goal setting with Daniel and Austin. I think it's a kind of topic that we should nearly keep rolling.
Just, you know what? I was thinking about it. The one thing I took away from it is that it's if you're around people as well who are kind of in that same mindset as you. So we have Ruby in a few days a week. I'd say he'll keep us on track.
No. He's the last person.
You said you missed accountability. If there is, I can't think of a better person to hold you to account than Ruby Walsh.
That's true, but he doesn't even see the other side of it then as well. Like,
who? Have you discussed it with you if you don't keep to
oh, yeah. He would be a perfect person to call, but he'd be too harsh on me. I'd start crying in front
of
him.
I read his book over Christmas. So when I had the few days off, I spent it reading Ruby Walsh's book. And it's fascinating just listening to his, reading his dedication from when he was like 17 years old, like wanting to make sure that he stayed on track with his weight because he was in school. Like, he went to dietitian and absolutely stuck to it rigidly for a full year when he was in his final year in school.
Have you noticed, because Jenny gave out to me about it, about a mild obsession with Ruby. She said, will you stop talking about Ruby?
Yeah, well, he's like, kind of a big character. And at the moment, we are surrounded by horse racing because it's on all the time. So every time I see a horse anyway, I think of Ruby. Even when I was on holidays, I saw a horse and I took a picture of it. It was a police horse and sent it to him.
You yeah, absolute right. Pothole. That's the worst thing. Do you know who loves horses? Ruby. Yeah. I'll send him this photo of this horse.
This police horse, yeah.
Oh my God, no wonder he's not replying to our WhatsApps when you're sending him rubbish like that.
He's probably going to leave the group now. Donica, that is all we have time for us tonight. The good news is Ruby will be back with us tomorrow.
Oh, hey, yippee.
Graham Smith is up next, and we're very excited about that because we don't usually get Graham Smith coming up after us.
Give it some, Graham. Give us a few tunes to get home.
Absolutely. Thanks, everyone, for listening. or add one play, so I'm just going to play as Jake.
Can I sing anything? Homegrown alligator, see you later. Gonna hit the road.
You keep singing there now. Gonna hit the road. I fixed it. Great news. Graham Smith is up next.
You're gone, Rusty.